Last year, Adam and I and a few hundred friends of DeSoto gathered in the Masonic Lodge inside a cemetery in the heart of Hollywood. Were we there to practice some dark rite? Some sinister ritual designed to bring deceased Star Trek actors back to the plane of the living? To bring an unholy horde of undead nerd celebrities to Earth to consume the brains of the living? No, we were just doing our live show of the Share Your Embarrassment Tour. It's our review of Star Trek V, and we filmed it. We just wanted to let you know to get ready for that live stream announcement coming next week. If you're a Max Fun member and you support our shows, you'll get access to discounted tickets from membership at MaximumFun.org. So, good time to make sure those emails are delivering properly to your inbox. Either way, we'll be announcing ticket links soon here and on our mailing list that you can sign up for at podshop.biz. The Share Your Embarrassment Tour is coming to your living room for one last stop, and you're not going to want to miss it.
Here's to the finest crew in Starfleet. Engage.
Captain Jean-Luc Picard of the U.S.
Commander Benjamin Sisko, the Federation Starbase, Deep Space Nine.
Welcome to the Greatest Generation, Deep Space Nine. It's a Star Trek podcast by a couple of guys who are a little bit embarrassed to have a Star Trek podcast. I'm Ben Harrison.
I'm Adam Pranica.
We hit a square, Adam. We hit a square on our last dice roll. I believe that was your dice roll, so this is your fault.
I feel like all the bad things that happen on the Game of Buttholes, Will of the Prophets are my fault. I feel like they're my rolls.
Really?
You know, for a fan community so interested in doing statistical analysis of our shows, that no one, I'm grateful for this, no one is trying to send us the metrics on whose fault things are.
Yeah.
Because I think that would be hurtful. I think that would drive a wedge between us, right?
I will occasionally click on a tweet or a Reddit thing or something and find somebody saying something about Adam's the funny one or, you know, Ben's the better impressionist or something like that. That's mean.
The internet makes it so easy to just say whatever you want without thinking about it. You just don't know. You don't know how things are going to come across.
I try very hard not to look at any of that stuff, but trust me, I have no self-control. I look. So assume whatever you're writing, I'm going to see it, for better or worse.
Uh-oh. I'm going to have to go back through my Reddit posts and my tweets now.
Yeah. You spend a lot of time using your tweets to drag me, King.
Yeah, so my bad dice roll has meant that we landed on a Measure of a Man episode.
It brings a sense of order and stability to my universe to know that you're still a pompous ass.
Courtroom is a crucible, and if we burn away irrelevances until we're left with a pure product, the truth.
When people of good conscience have an honest dispute, we must still sometimes resort to this kind of adversarial system. Hopefully we can make some good law out here.
And for good measure, sit on this.
It's one of the classic Game of Buttholes squares. It's where we flip a coin before we do the show to decide which side of the... it's sort of like Count Pointer Count from the Kentucky Fried Movie. It's the classic debate show where you take one side and I take the other.
Episode that's in honor of Philippa Louvois, who asked one member of the TNG crew to argue the pro and the other to argue the con.
That's right. Like any big game, we have a special coin to flip to determine who will be taking the pro and who will be taking the con side as we discuss this episode. And for that, Ben, I've got our most recent Greatest Gen Challenge coin. It's the Friend of DeSoto, Fan of Special Conscience coin. I think it's one of our best pieces of work here.
Adam, do you have a slip of paper or something? Because I thought it might be fun for us before we flip the coin to write the side we would prefer to be on down. Like, fold it up, hide it, and then at the end of the episode, reveal whether we got what we wanted or not.
It's a great idea. I've got a notepad right here.
Okay, great.
So we're writing down pro or con, or just did you like or did you not like?
I'm saying, like, in your heart, what do you hope the coin tells you to do? Because it's going to tell one of us to argue vehemently in favor.
That's a very different question than how you really feel. Okay, write down a plus or a minus, I would say.
Okay, so plus is I wish I was pro. Uh-huh. Minus is I wish I was con.
Yeah.
It's possible we both write down the same symbol here.
It is. Uh-oh, you're writing a lot. This is like that moment on Jeopardy when someone is just writing and writing and writing during final. Yeah. You're like, what are they writing?
I'm drawing a dick, but it will only be revealed when it's asked how much I've wagered.
Yeah. So here's the thing. I will say that heads is positive. It's the pro side. And our Greatest Generation logo is the con side.
Okay.
And so I'm going to be flipping for you.
Okay.
So there's no shenanigans. You're watching me too. You got the video feed on. Here we go. It actually rolled under the guest room bed. I've got to go get it.
This is going great. Adam is now on the floor of the guest room / podcast studio.
All right, Ben, I picked it up and I haven't looked at it. I've sort of clamshelled it between my hands. I'm going to take the upper clamshell hand off.
All right.
I'm going to tell you what I see.
Lay it on me, baby.
All right, your job this episode is to argue for the pro.
Okay.
There's Kevin wow. Uxbridge there.
I am officially pro Times Orphan.
One
of the best episodes of Star Trek ever made.
Kevin Uxbridge, known for being like the most positive alien we've ever run into. Just a man who's like just bubbly with pleasure. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Really a man enjoying his life and everything about it.
A man so overcome with positivity that he turns into a being of pure energy.
The thing I didn't get to tell you was just how happy I am. I'm a one-woman man. I've been trying to tell you that from the start.
And Rashaan's great and all, but I'm an extrovert. I wanted to hang out with other people. Do you know how hard this has been? Some could say that I loved the Hoosnack too much.
The thing that I detested about the Hoosnack most was just how negative they were about everything. Huge bummers, the Hoosnack were.
I tried to fix that by hugging all of them, but I hugged them so hard. I had no idea what I was doing.
I really Lennied the Hoosnack.
Okay, well, do you want to get into Times Orphan, Season 6, Episode 24?
I wish we weren't, Ben. One of the worst episodes, I would say.
Wow. Already in character.
Do you realize how incredible this is?
No, of course you don't.
Ben, missed Keiko.
Yeah, I was wondering who the hell Miles was waking up with. I thought, you know, for a moment I was like, finally, he's moving on. I don't remember whatever happened to Keiko, but this is healthy.
He definitely has a type if that's not Keiko. it was a breath of fresh air.
Mr. O'Brien, I was very happy to read your 5-star review of the Keiko doll.
Nice to have her back. Nice to have Molly back. I nearly forgot about Kira Yoshi.
So did I.
Like, totally came as a pleasant, delightful surprise. They're back on the station because the war has presumably died down somewhat.
They've reopened Deep Space Nine.
Yeah,
I don't know, Ben. It feels like they're reopening early.
Yeah, it could be dangerous to go out just yet. But yeah, I mean, like, this is an episode about optimism for the future, I suppose. So, which I'm all about.
Right. I don't know. I mean, it would have been, here's the reason why we forgot about Keiko. It's because Miles never mentions her in the, what, like 20 previous episodes that she's been gone? I mean, I guess he mentions Keiko in that episode where he goes undercover with the mobsters, right?
I have a girlfriend.
He's been faithful to Keiko despite lots of opportunities not to be.
You get no credit for doing the right thing, Ben.
No, yeah.
You never do.
He's having that experience with Molly that that I have every time I see my brother-in-law's new puppy, which is like, I cannot believe this is the same dog. It is double the size as last time I saw it. Molly's growing up.
Can't believe how much she's grown since I saw her last.
Look who's talking.
She has not grown up to the extent that she knows not to just enter her parents' bedroom unannounced. She could have seen... She could have seen the haggis on accident.
Yeah. Fortunately, she is spared that mental image that would have been with her for the rest of her life. And she's very excited because it's picnic day.
Oh, well, we better get going then.
Keiko packs a picnic with no hog, though, because she has encouraged Miles to go on a diet in a pretty damaging kind of... She kind of body shames Miles O'Brien here. It's not
well,
nice.
Well, that's true. I know, but they're a married couple. She loves him. She wants him to be healthy.
You're arguing that she's doing this from a place of positivity, like she wants him to be better by rubbing circles around his rotund belly and and saying you've really gained a few while I've been gone. That would never work in the other direction, Ben.
I agree. I think some of these things are this show is a product of its time. I also think that there are fewer like cultural valences attendant to it when it goes the other way, you know?
Yeah. This picnic trip to Golana seems like a thing that would happen all the time if you're a Starfleet, right?
Like this is a day of trip, right? Like they get on the shuttle and fly there for presumably lunch that day. So
if this
Golana
possible,
4
I would do
is
this
close.
All the time. Yeah, it's inside the Bajoran system for sure.
Golana 4 looks awesome.
I don't know if this was my feed or what, but I found the resolution of the planet really pixelated and bad. Am I having internet problems?
I think you're having internet problems.
Okay. All right. Well, I didn't think the episode was as crystal clear as it usually is, so maybe
Adam,
you gotta do that.
Try criticizing the episode on its merits as a story, maybe, and not the way the transfer went when the film footage went to the digital transfer house.
Maybe I should unplug and replug in my router while we're doing the show just to sort of clear things out.
You want to pull a Roderick?
Yeah. Yeah. This is a thing I would do all the time, Ben. The day trip to a planet just to picnic there.
Yeah.
And the planet looks every bit like the Malibu outdoor playset that we've gotten dozens of times before. It's beautiful.
It's a verdant pasture with trees on the hillsides, and there's a entrance to some Star Trek caves nearby. They're having a great time.
O'Brien is on the picnic blanket and he's making promises. He's making promises about never again sending his family away if things get dangerous. Keiko's like, how can you make a promise like that? And Miles O'Brien's like, well, because if the war pops up again, I'm asking for a transfer. What? You can do that?
I wonder how that works. Like we've talked a lot about like what life might be like in the parts of the Federation that are not Starfleet. When you're at war, do they conscript soldiers in the Federation? Or is it an all-volunteer army fighting the Jem'Hadar?
I mean, this is an interesting question, right? If you were to consider the consequences of that on board something like a ship full of families, for example, a galaxy-class starship. I mean, imagine what would happen if the Big D were engaged in a battle and all of a sudden much of his crew decided that, maybe this is too dangerous for families and I'd like off this ship.
Separating the saucer is the requesting a transfer of galaxy-class life.
You know, we referred to statisticians in our audience before. I would like to know the ratio of battles the Enterprise got in to times they separated the saucer. I don't think they took advantage of that ability like they could have.
Yeah. I mean, that's something that we talked about a lot when we were reviewing TNG. It'd be cool if there was a part of the space station that came off and flew away.
They, like, in reality, in quote-unquote reality, they would have separated the saucer so much that the locking mechanism that holds the saucer on, like, they would have been worn. Like, you couldn't make a good seal after a certain amount of time between the saucer and the star drive.
Yeah, it gets a little bit loose, and then you have to have, like, a locksmith come out and, and rejigger it.
Do you have any, like, credentials or, like, a license to be a locksmith that you could just show us?
No, the only thing you need to be a locksmith, you gotta want it.
Molly runs off. She's playing around. Yoshi is being cute and distracting mom and dad. So they are caught unawares when Molly starts calling out for help.
Molly?
And it turns out that she has gone into these Star Trek caves. Classic blunder. And is literally hanging by her fingertips on the edge of a pit. And, you know, Miles reaches out to try and pull her up, and she slips, and he watches her fall into, like, Ghostbusters goo.
If you like the first set piece in the movie Cliffhanger, I bet you love this cold open. And I did. I loved Cliffhanger. Yeah. Nothing wrong with that movie. Wouldn't kick that movie out of bed. But I think my problem with the scene is everything about how Molly ended up hanging on the side of the cliff by her fingertips. What happened? Was she doing cartwheels all the way into the cave?
I think we can only assume that she was doing cartwheels into the cave. Gul Dukat. Dukat. Gul Dukat. So, the Bajor sector, Adam, is lousy with time travel devices. We know this.
Yeah.
This is a well-established truth about Bajor. People are time traveling there all the time. And it's no surprise that one of the outlying planets would also have a time travel device. This is the device left by a civilization from thousands of years ago. And it was on for all that time, but Molly falling through it turned it off.
This would be so irritating if I were, like, an ancient Bajoran or an Iaconian or something. Like, you got to turn it off before you leave, guys.
Yeah, last one out shuts the lights. Come on. If your civilization is dying off, do everyone a favor.
You know what? People are going to make assumptions about how wasteful we are. Someone left the thermostat on for 3,000 years.
Look at this bill. Who's going to pay this?
Yeah. Yeah, and this is how accidents happen. You leave on the time portal, and it's dangerous for anyone that follows.
It's a great start to a great episode, because the what could be more motivating for a character than the loss of a child?
Oh, yeah. It's one of the reasons why you see so many episodes about the loss of children in Star Trek. Just a rich tapestry of feelings and challenges for our favorite characters.
And such an evocative setup, too, because it's a technical problem, and the chief can throw his great technical prowess into trying to save his daughter.
This scene is hilarious to me because, like, we basically cut to Starfleet's just swarming this thing, and everyone's talking in hushed voices. Like, Kira and Dax are like, "So what exactly happened?" And Dax is like, You know the story, Kira. Chronoton particles.
It's some sort of time portal.
You idiot. Everyone knows that.
And then, weirdly, it cuts to the bridge of the Enterprise E.
Yeah.
It's time travel.
And the reason they're keeping their voices down is because O'Brien has been there the whole time. Like, he's working the problem, too. And so is Keiko, like, with a babe in arms, is down there. And that's a dangerous spot because, like, stuff is exploding all around them. Miles does not have his mind totally on his work because stuff is exploding that he's turning wrenches on.
Did you think that those glowing spheres that he was messing with were the, like, power sources that were left behind by the ancient civilization?
It feels like there is a break in the continuity because we were just in this cave. We saw what the gate looked like, And now it doesn't look anything at all like what we saw before.
What are you talking about? It's a trapezoidal stargate, Adam.
I just mean its location in the cave. I don't know. Mm. It looked a little weird to me, and it's light enough to move. That's fun. Like we get a scene where a couple of crew people like get a shoulder under it and start moving it around.
I would be really worried that this 300-year-old thing would break if I started to move it around.
Right.
The plan is pretty ingenious, though. There's, you know, if they can turn this thing back on, it's going to be a portal to the same time and place. So, presuming that is possible, they can just shoot a transporter beam through it, looking for Molly's DNA signature, and they'll be able to pull her out.
Easy as that.
There's a lot that needs to be fixed, a lot that needs to be calibrated, and this gives Miles and Keiko an opportunity to have a little conversation, which I thought was crucial for kind of setting the tone of how terrible this is for them. Like, what a panic, like a sustained panic they've been in for hours.
Miles, I'm getting scared. You've been at it all day.
Try to imagine, like, the grocery store that you've lost your child in spans not only space, but time.
Like, she's like, in the cereal aisle 300 years ago.
I mean, you could ask the manager to put a call out on the PA, but I mean, that's not going to help. I'm sorry, ma'am. The PA system only works in the now time.
Good afternoon, Shepherds. Pedro Mart is offering a special on Hesperat in aisle 7. 300 years in the past. Sorry you missed out.
We also get a scene where Kira has taken Kiriyoshi up to the little D. And this is kind of, there's a big B story about Dax and Worf looking after Kiriyoshi for the rest of the episode. And this scene almost is complicates that fact because Kira is sort of Kiriyoshi's second mom.
Right.
You know, like they have a really strong connection. And the scene is mainly there to kind of pose the question of like, what are you looking for long term between the new couple of Kira and Odo?
This moment goes totally uninterrogated for the rest of the episode, because when we cut back to Odo's face after Kira's like,
I think I might want to have one of my own someday.
It's totally like, bong. And Odo's like, if you want a child so much, look down at my leg. There. Now it's a baby.
I wondered, like, does Odo... Because I think that you can interpret that one of a couple of ways. Like, is Odo wondering in that moment, like, can I even do that with her? Or does he know already?
Can Odo shoot?
I don't know. I mean, if a Klingon and a human can make a baby, it seems like a lot of things are possible.
Do you think when Odo was briefly corporeal, like he shot some samples into some...
I made a couple of deposits in the sperm bank on the station, setting it aside for such time as...
What would his genetic structure be? Because his face didn't change. Like, his genetics must be really strange, right?
You know, I made that mistake only once when I reached into my refrigerator, and never again.
You'll have to forgive me, Odo. Of course, it was the same color as you are when you revert to your gelatinous state. Who could sue me for making the mistake that I made? Assuming it was a different bodily substance.
You'll be happy to know that I did not swallow.
I spat it back. There is some concern that my DNA is now mixed in there.
How fucking magical would it be if that is called back and Odo is like, yeah, banked it. Ready when you are, Kira.
Get out the turkey baster. Daddy's ready to go.
Yeah, but instead, this is just a shot reverse shot B story element. And Ben, like, this entire B story I read was shot after the fact. They intended for this to be just a story bottle episode, and they came up like 9 minutes short or something.
No,
and they shot
kidding.
The entire B story after the fact.
Wow.
Isn't that nuts?
Now that is excellent filmmaking.
That's the thing. Like, that's, it's, I believe it, but also it's unbelievable. Like, there is a math that you do when you're writing a script that draws an equivalency between pages and minutes. And this is a show that's done it for almost 7 seasons, 26 episodes a piece or whatever.
You would think that they would have that dialed in.
I'm shocked that they missed the target that wide. Amazing.
That's amazing. Well, maybe they missed the target by like 3 minutes, but there was also like a 6 minute scene of O'Brien like working out and, you know, and like trying to like do a plant-based diet to impress his wife.
Right. Yeah. You know what? Take out all the Worf stuff. Give me the O'Brien getting ripped montage.
I lost a bunch of weight last year and my wife wishes I would put it back on.
That's cool.
It's great.
I wish
very
you would,
encouraging.
I wish you would start smoking again, Ben. I liked your voice the other way.
Could you go back to drinking a lot of beer?
To be quite honest about it, I was in a pail.
A bucket.
A pail.
Mr. Bucket,
I have to revert back to my little state. I don't use the bucket anymore.
I think we should call this what it is. Like, this is a time travel episode.
Yeah.
And I was begging for them to scan the planet for her remains, for Molly's remains. Why didn't they do that?
Or like find archaeological evidence of her.
There's a moment where they're like, okay, Odo, go do the research, you know, with the archives to see what the gate is. And I fully expected Odo to come back with a skull and be like, here she is.
I'm sorry, Chief. I mean, like, you could do that and it would still all work, right?
Because that's what I'm saying, yeah.
The mechanics of the time travel, unlike our most recent Kira time travel episode, are like very well defined in this episode, but only at the end, right?
Is it too much like finding Data's head in San Francisco? Like, would it be too derivative of that? I don't think
Maybe.
So.
I don't know. But yeah, they reactivate the Stargate temporal field, reestablished. They activate the transporter beam, they get the lock, and a cave girl basically materializes on the platform. This is Molly at age 18, and she has totally gone feral.
She's Cro-Mag Molly.
See, how can you be against this episode, Adam?
One of the very first movies I ever watched as a film studies major was Truffaut's The Wild Child. Did you ever see that movie?
I did not.
Got real Wild Child vibes from this one. So things do not go well when Cro-Mag Molly materializes on the pad. She is not gentle with anyone during the reunion. She goes right in for a bite of O'Brien's forearm.
Mm-hmm.
Sets the tone.
She's like nonverbal. She has lost her civilization, as it were. And so we cut up to Six Bay on the little D, and the doctor starts to explain. There's not really like a playbook for this because your daughter has spent the last 10 years of her life subjectively in a total wilderness, like having to survive with only her wits.
In France, she would be called La Renard. And she would be hunted with only her cunning to protect her.
And no human stimulation to, you know, cultivate her linguistic skills or anything else. So this is going to be a process. You've suddenly got an 18-year-old daughter who needs to be like brought up to speed on the 24th century. And that's just the burden you're going to have to bear as her parents.
This was my favorite thought experiment in the episode happens here, where Keiko's like, well, cool, let's send her back through the portal and then retrieve 8-year-old Molly again. Like, this one's a dud. Like, what's the problem with that? And Bashir says, if you do that, you effectively kill 18-year-old Molly. And in that moment, I was like, what's the difference? It's such an interesting argument of temporal morality that I wish they, I wish we lived in this argument a little bit longer, because to argue either side of this, I think would have been a fascinating exercise. Like, are you really killing a future person by restoring them to their past? Aren't they exactly the same person? Are you giving additional value to an older person versus a younger person? And why, if you are? Like, so many questions.
Yeah, I think that if you want to see those questions asked and answered, you're going to want to watch the Tuvix episode of Star Trek Voyager.
Oh, the classic Tuvix episode that everyone loves?
Yeah, that one.
We should do that episode next. Anyway, I was...
People would fucking carry us out of town on a rail if we just did the Tuvix episode next.
Hey, man, it doesn't take much anymore. So, I was on Team Keiko here, and I remained on Team Keiko throughout. They should have shoved her back through the portal.
I mean, I think that in the episode's defense, the idea that she has gained 10 years of life experience is pretty compelling. And Keiko is asking for them to erase the person that happened to so that she can have the person that she wants back. And I think that there is like a questionable morality to that.
Yeah, but Dr. Bashir doesn't feel issues of questionable morality. He lobotomized Kern, and he didn't lose a wink of sleep over it.
Well, maybe he's trying to like be a better man now, Adam. Did you ever consider that?
If you had only sent me through a Bajoran time portal, I could have avoided the lobotomy that came later.
Think of a person who would be better suited to live on a deserted planet 300 years in the past. I'll wait.
Name a more iconic duo than Kern on a deserted planet. Yeah, man, that'd be super fun. Also, like, who knows more about being de-evolved on the station than Worf? They should have involved Worf right here and now. Like, if someone knows what it's like to adjust to both de-evolving and then evolving again, he's been through it all.
Re-evolving?
Yeah. Yeah. I bring up Worf because he is the B story. He and Dax are on babysitting duty for young Yoshi. And Worf comes home and it's like time for Dax to do work. And Worf's like, well, I can watch Yoshi, it's cool. And Dax is like, you're not exactly great with kids. And then for some reason, Worf uses Alexander as an example of how great he is at being a father. I don't think that example means what you think it means, Worf.
I raised Alexander.
That's different.
I think that in Worf's defense, he tried very hard with Alexander. Nobody tried harder with Alexander than Worf.
No, I mean, that's true. We can agree on that. No one tried harder than Worf. Worf didn't try that hard.
I'll concede that one point, okay?
They've turned the cargo bay into a kind of hamster pen where, like, there's a log and a big rock and a giant water bottle for the feral Molly to interact with and climb all around on.
Put him in a mayonnaise jar with a stick and a leaf to recreate what he's used to.
Glad they had the cargo space for this.
The Enterprise-D had an arboretum. The Deep Space Nine space station has a cargo-retum.
They also combed and flat-ironed Molly's hair, which is nice.
Yeah, she got styled while she was asleep, apparently, and made up. She wakes up amidst a lot of artifice. She sees this rock and it reaches out and touches it, and you can just see this is a fake rock wash over her face. And then she looks up and her parents are there. Chief O'Brien and Keiko are standing there, you know, doing the like, we're not going to hurt you, but standing at a distance thing. And they've brought her some millet. This is, I guess, a type of fruit that is native to Galana, which is where she was marooned.
Molly looks down and she's like, why are my legs shaved? There was a moment where she looks at her own arms, and it made me wonder if what she was processing was that she was clean. Did you get that? Like, and how strange that had to be?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that there's a lot of really great subtle stuff like that in this episode.
I think the actor who plays older Molly does a really good job at, like, I think the trap here is, like, you could really nail this one up in a way that, like, doesn't work. And I think she pulls back from going the full nail with it.
Yeah. This is Michelle Kruziak, who's an actor who is still working. She's in the she's in that show Hollywood on Netflix.
Whoa, no way. That's great.
Yeah. She's in four episodes of that.
I always like clicking on an actor's official website. The official websites for actors are always so fun.
They're made with like whatever the equivalent of Squarespace was like in 1998.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it exactly. Pretty fun.
but they're still like figuring out ways to like embed YouTube clips and stuff.
I would say 9 out of 10 actors' websites you still see like digging GIF on a road sign.
Yeah, appearances, and then like that part is like under construction and has been for the last 6 years.
Right.
What are you doing now?
Exactly. They approach her like the feral person she is, like a person who has only moments ago bitten Miles O'Brien in the arm. Like, I think they're using a fair amount of caution here.
Yeah.
What they have is a dolly for her, this dolly that she should recognize and does.
I mean, I think you make a great point, right? Like the feralness of her is something that they had to decide at some point. Like, mm-hmm. Is she going to be semi-verbal? Is she going to have her mind arrested at 8 years old? Is this dolly going to mean the same thing to her now or not? Are all like interesting questions. And I wonder like how you even research an episode like this if there's like source material you can lean on.
I mean, it was my understanding that they did do that research and like actually worked with child psychologists to get it right.
Wow.
Which is surprising given the track record of a show that, you know, chooses to be interested in the in the reality of
yeah.
moments, like just sort of, you know, when it suits them.
Right. I hope their child psychologist expert wasn't the same expert that they had to consult on Native American portrayals in Star Trek Voyager.
Yeah. For example, where are the caseworkers at this point was a question I had, because I mean, the doctor isn't around. The doctor just sort of trusts that Miles and Keiko are going to take care of this one.
And I love that about the episode, that they are parents that believe in their ability to reconnect with this child. They don't want some pencil neck telling them what to do. They want to do this themselves. They want to do the hard work.
You know, one
aspect...
That's
what's good about this episode, Adam.
this is a show that chooses to hurt Miles O'Brien so often.
This is a ball, buddy. Bollocks!
You know, I wonder if one of the ways they considered and then scrapped as a way to do that was to present the idea that, you know, how much could an 8-year-old Molly recognize her father anyway? With how rarely she sees him. And like, I could laugh about that too, Ben, but also like in an episode like this, like how hurtful would it be for her to start to recognize Keiko first and not Miles because
right.
of the choices that Miles made in the years and seasons leading up to this moment. Like the aspect of Miles O'Brien being a regretful absentee father who made choices, you know, for their protection, it cuts both ways, right? Like these are reasonable
yeah.
choices
yeah.
that he's made, but they have consequences too. And that could have been one of them.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's like an interesting story to tell. The like pain of seeing a good faith decision you made turned against you would be Tef. But that's not the story that they're trying to tell here.
It always is, Ben. Molly is making a kind of ball pit for her dolly in a fun way. She's just not getting it. She's not good at sharing. If Keiko was a primary school teacher, I feel like Molly's grades at this point need improvement.
Molly is like my character in Skyrim. Like, it takes very long to get across the overworld because she's collected too many items and can't bring herself to give any of them up.
Yeah. Brief interstitial here between Dax and Worf, which doesn't really matter, does it?
Worf is night nursing Yoshi. Yoshi's crying late at night. And Worf is the one that's staying up. It's great. It's modeling being an active participant in the rearing of a child for men who need that.
I have pulled Yoshi to my bosom, and yet he does not sleep.
He feels judged by Dax, and this is a thing that I feel like is familiar to you and me, Ben, which is like you are fighting a battle in your mind with a person you're close to that isn't actually happening.
Right.
And you're projecting the terms of this battle in the moment on that person.
He expresses that his whole interest in looking after Yoshi is to demonstrate a prowess at child rearing to Dax to, you know, make her comfortable with the idea that she has married him. And at every turn, she's like, I don't need to be reassured with regards to that. I married you. Like, I knew what I was signing up for.
The minute I met Tony, I knew who that guy was.
Yeah, man. There was something very familiar about these moments to me.
Yeah. That's like the kind of insecurity that Worf is great at expressing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Like, if there's one good thing about the B story, I think it was that familiarity with that moment. I think there's something to be gained from experiencing that through Worf and Dax's relationship.
They make a bit of a breakthrough with Cro-Mag Molly surrounding a hairbrush, which she is very interested in Keiko's hairbrush when she pulls it out. And I thought that was a really touching detail because I imagine I don't have a little girl with long hair, but I imagine that that's like a big part of their day every day, getting their hair brushed out. And
right.
And that would be like a very familiar object to a kid that hasn't seen one in 10 years.
And a sense memory, too. It feels good to have your hair brushed.
Yeah, to get fussed over a little bit. Mm-hmm. And the next scene is basically O'Brien and Bashir walking down the hallway. And O'Brien's like, this is going great. We're going to have her talking and in no time. She's going to probably be applying to college this time next year.
Well, just be careful not to push it too hard, Miles. If she gets frustrated, she might withdraw and relapse into her old behavior pattern.
My problem with this scene is, why is Chief O'Brien going to work? How does he not have time off to take care of this situation? Did he use up all, like, was the last of his vacation time spent on that picnic? Because that was a bad use of your vacay time there, Miles.
You would hope that that Sisko would give him a little bit of leeway in a situation like this, but
yeah, it turns out O'Brien's going to need Sisko's leeway a little later.
Yeah, he doesn't want to use it up just yet.
Bashir in this scene like cautions Chief O'Brien not to get overconfident here, not to push her.
And then they come into Worf's quarters and find that Worf has been teaching Yoshi a Klingon art called Hekdup, which is a hand-eye coordination technique that is taught to little babies so that they'll be good warriors when they grow up big and tall.
Oh, I get it. The rattle is like the baby's first batleth kind of thing.
The evidence for Yoshi's advancement in this area is splattered all over the walls because he has killed their cat.
He acquitted himself well.
But honestly, I mean, I'm not supposed to be arguing this side, but I'm going to dabble a little bit. Like, it's like devil's advocacy.
Like, you're a little bit verse.
I think one of the things this episode does well is, like, I was feeling the tension of the violence that was going to happen. Like, I could just feel that Feral Molly was going to either kill the cat or seriously injure one of her parents or hurt herself in a major way. And it takes so long to get there.
We come back to the cargo bay where she's having a total freak out and saying that she wants to go home. And Miles and Keiko interpret this as she wants to go to their apartment. So they take her there and the cat is there. And I was like very concerned that she was going to like kill and attempt to like spit roast the cat.
Yeah, I felt the same way. Instead, she rips a bodice she found in her old closet.
Yeah. Crucially, a bodice that's not on anyone. So it's not, it doesn't mean the same thing.
You know what? Like there's an economy to this scene that I didn't consider until this moment, Ben, because it's been so long since we've seen Molly. I bet none of these clothes that she's destroying would fit her anymore anyway. Go ahead and tear them up.
We were going to donate those, but you do you.
Right.
She finds a picture of them, though, and this is presumably a picture that they took while they were on the picnic, because it's a picture of the place that they had the picnic, and that's where she really wants to go.
Right.
She doesn't consider this apartment to be home.
And this is going to be easy to solve for, because Miles and Keiko are like, let's just make Galana on the holosuite. And Quark is like, cool, how much sex do you want to have there? Miles and Keiko are like, no, it's not that kind of Galana.
He's got a variety of different Galana games to choose from, and they pick the most PG-rated version.
Right.
But this makes Molly extremely happy, and they are walking around in this field while she just giggles and runs and jumps and hangs from trees. She's delighted.
I feel like this is an acting challenge. That the actor who plays Cro-Mag Molly really pulls off. Like, this is not ham and cheese. This is just like pure joy.
Right. There's something very challenging about depicting a character that is like extremely limited verbal skills without making them look dumb or like we're making fun of that character.
That is the line. Yeah.
And I never felt like that.
Yeah. Unfortunately, like this good feeling can't be felt forever, because there's been kind of a line. There's a lineup outside the holosuite.
What's going on in there?
Just a minute.
And a couple of Klingon fellas have gotten next up. They've got their quarters on the door.
Listen, we just really want to kill some like guys with turtle faces and skull faces. So if you guys could move it along, that would be great.
Computer end program does not go well, Enterprise, because as soon as fake Galana goes away, Molly has a breakdown, and it is spectacular.
It's a tantrum that spills out of the holosuites and into the bar. She Walter Sobchak's Quark's ear as she comes out, and that like I kind of wish we'd seen a chunk of it go flying across the room,
right? In it like patooey,
yeah. But she like she fights her way through the bar. She like shoves a bunch of people down the steps, and then she bottle stabs a guy on her way out the door.
And then Odo has a Bajoran security guy shoot her on stun.
On stun.
But Odo looks over at the Bajoran security guy, and he's like, "Shoot her." Because up until this moment, Cro-Mag Molly has been like testing the perimeter defenses of the holosuite for weaknesses.
Yeah. When she looks at you, you can see she's working things out.
Odo has a McLaughlin group.
Issue one.
With Sisko and O'Brien, and he says, "I think we need to institute the lysine contingency."
It's not so much the Cro-Mag Molly in front of you. It's the two Cro-Mag Mollies you don't see attacking from the side.
I'm just concerned that she might be too clever of a girl for station safety.
Morn. Dear sweet. Morn.
You need everybody?
Morn.
Stop. Hammer time.
I thought this was kind of chicken shit of Odo. Like, for A, Odo not to either shoot Molly himself or to become like the non-lethal weapon that he could be. Like he could like net her and take her to the floor or something.
Totally.
We haven't seen that effect in a long time. It must be expensive.
I was thinking about that today, that, you know, they do that thing, I think, in episode one where somebody tries to, like, punch him in the face and his head goes gold and he, like, uses his goo to flip the guy over.
Yeah.
And I wonder if they feel like they've just burned that. If they ever do it again, it will seem like they've rung the bell too many times.
I don't know, man. I've got an insatiable hunger for a Cro-Magmali taking a broken bottle, sticking it through Odo's torso, and then us cutting to the back of him as the bottle is, like, being twisted around after having gone through him. Give me more of that. Give me enough of that to where I'm tired of it, and I'm not tired of it yet.
Yeah, leave him wanting more. That's the art of good television, Adam.
Unfortunately, the guy she stabbed with the bottle is pressing charges, and Odo can't talk him out of it.
He cannot. Molly does not respond well to being in a holding cell. She's doing that thing where she just runs up against the force field over and over again.
This is the moment where I started to feel very sad for her. Like, there's really no hope for Cro-Magmali at this point. And the whole feeling of the episode is the same. Like, Bashir's demeanor changes. I think Miles and Keiko get it at this point. And that's before they're told that the Federation is going to be involved. And that's, like, the final straw. Like, they're going to be made to abandon the child. I abandoned my girl.
O'Brien, all he wanted really to do was to drink someone else's milkshake, and now look at him, you know? Yeah, and to make matters worse, the situation is not great for their other kid either. Kiriyoshi has been over in the Worf Dax quarters bonking his head, presumably on the little table that Worf keeps his suicide poison vials. You know, everybody is there to say, like, little kids bonk their heads. It's fine. They run around, they bonk. But Worf is really beating the shit out of himself over this.
You and I famously are both childless, but we, I think, are fortunate to have plenty of good friends with kids that that we'll play with from time to time. Yeah. Super fun. But man, I totally felt what Worf felt like when a kid in your care hurts themselves. It is the worst feeling in the world.
I have my friend's daughter. I was visiting them on vacation a few years ago, and we were doing the thing where I was like swinging her in a circle, and she
she
got the nursemaid elbow thing, and it was like. It's like, yeah. I felt like dog shit for a week, and everybody was like, no, it's like, it's a thing that happens to kids. It was over. Like, we took her to a doctor and they fixed it and it was fine. And I've never not felt bad about it. I think back on it right now, I feel terrible.
Yeah. Yeah. One of our friends did the same thing to one of our friend's kids.
And you never talked to them again, right?
No. Yeah. They were ostracized.
Yeah.
Rightfully.
Yeah. That's what happened to me also.
Worf sees this as an example of him being an utter failure as a parent.
Yeah.
This is almost like the last straw.
Yeah. I thought it was amazing that an episode that's so focused on something else could find a way to make that point. Worf is a terrible parent, you know?
Finally, we have confirmation.
And finally, he has some insight into that.
Right.
I failed Alexander. I failed Kiriyoshi. And I would have failed our children as well.
Miles and Keiko are post-gaming this, and it seems like they're ready to give up. Until Keiko kind of draws out the idea that maybe Miles isn't giving up. Maybe Miles has a secret plan he's ready to hatch.
Yeah.
A plan that goes like stealing a runabout and taking Cro-Magmali down to euthanize her in the time portal.
It's not to euthanize her, it's to send her where she wants to go, Adam. And where she is safe from the, you know, institutions that want to enforce
She's going to be very safe all alone on a deserted planet where all she has is sharpened sticks to defend herself. That's great. Yeah.
Hey, listen, she's safe. She survived there as an 8-year-old. It can't be that dangerous of a place.
This scene and this plan is not specific enough. And the reason that I went there with my description of it is that you can't argue that that's not what they're taking her to go do. Like, her fate is sealed should they put her back in the time portal.
Yeah. They're going to maroon her in the past to protect her from the present. And they do have to commit a crime to do it in breaking her out of jail. And they get the go-ahead from Odo in the hallway. Like, a Federation security guy catches them. And Odo comes down and he's like, all right, you two kids get along.
This is a very rewarding scene because I feel like the show doesn't often pay off a long-term relationship in this way with such efficiency.
Yeah.
Odo's like, I know you, O'Brien, and I know what you're capable of, and I would have expected a better plan than this. Like, yeah. He expected a foolproof escape plan. I love that moment.
Yep. And he knows that what O'Brien is doing is, you know, closer to justice than what O'Brien is trying to prevent. So it's very true to Odo's character too. Like, the, you know, on the side of justice, not the letter of the law thing that he aspires to.
Another thing that we can agree is totally true is that Starfleet is totally uninterested in guarding anything time travel related, because when O'Brien gets back down to the time gate, no one's there.
Yeah, all the stuff is totally still plugged deserted. In. They're able to turn it back on.
What the fuck? It's so stupid.
Yeah. Well, what they cut out, the 9 minutes that they cut out was them standing in the line of people waiting to go kill Hitler and stuff.
I love that O'Brien had to get through no more than two security people on the station to get to the runabout and zero security people at the time portal.
Yeah. They say a tearful goodbye to Cro-Mag Molly. They give her a Manhattan Portage shoulder bag, presumably full of some provisions that she may find useful in the life she is returning to.
Wouldn't it have been rad if they gave her a phaser?
Like, oh yeah.
I want to know Molly's everyday carry.
Yeah.
Based on the size of that bag.
What's in the kit? Is there like a flat pack replicator in there?
This ties back into that question of whether or not this is euthanasia or not.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how much of a chance are they willing to give her? I would argue that if they're good parents, they're going to stuff that bag with everything she could possibly need.
Yeah, I'm guessing they did.
Yeah.
Molly expresses maybe the most complex verbal thing that she expresses in the entire episode, which is,
Molly loves you.
And then walks through the portal.
Old Molly goes through the time portal, sees young Molly on the other side, touches her, and then destroys the universe.
it's actual Back to the Future mechanics. It's actual.
This is what confused me so much about the documentary about Deep Space Nine, is that they never refer to this moment.
No, yeah, this... It was like a pretty insane way to end the series, I think.
Yeah. But I think very real given what we know about time paradoxes, right?
Right, yeah. The time-space continuum cannot abide two people who are the same touching each other.
Yeah.
No, but she's getting ready to send 8-year-old Molly back through the portal, and we're cutting back to the other side where Chief O'Brien is getting out a phaser and getting ready to destroy this thing to, like, fully seal Molly behind the portal. And older Molly gives younger Molly her dolly and, like, gestures for the portal. And she's about halfway through when the chief shoots the portal, and she is cut in half, and her and her lower torso falls to the ground in front of Miles and Keiko, and we cut to credits.
So Miles half bobs his daughter.
Yeah.
Oh, that's actually, it's Bob half when it's the lower half that yeah. survives, right? We established that on the hit podcast Friendly Fire.
Yeah.
Did you understand fully why Miles needed to destroy the portal? Was it to prevent anyone from going and bringing Molly back?
Yeah. Yeah, that was the logic of it. The excellent logic of it, Adam. Because this is a good episode that is flawless.
I don't know. So young Molly comes through. We're made to understand that these were moments, right? Young Molly was on the other side for a moment of her time.
I got the feeling that she was there for a long time because she's like grubby and messed up looking.
That's what I'm saying. Like the hair tangle continuity alone would suggest that she'd been there for quite a while. But I think the dialogue is the thing that suggests that it happens almost simultaneously.
Yeah.
So maybe the part that is the most science fiction, the absolute most unbelievable part of this episode, the part that I just cannot believe was not edited in some way, is that Worf comes home to Dax in their quarters, and he's still mega bummed about what happened to Yoshi. And Dax tells Worf that very night they've been invited over to dinner at the O'Briens. The O'Briens, for some reason, are not too tired for company after recovering their time-traveling daughter and going through the stresses of raising Cro-Mag Molly for, what, like a week to 10 days?
Sometimes when you've been through a harrowing situation, you want to celebrate when you come out the other side, Adam.
If I have recorded two shows in a day, I don't want to see anyone. I don't want to see my wife that night. Too tired for that. It just seems unbelievable that they wouldn't want some alone time with their newly found regular Molly.
Wow. I heartily disagree. I think that the O'Briens are just happy to have everyone back together, and they want to fete Worf and Dax for looking after Kiriyoshi and teaching him how to do hecked up so well.
Is Molly better with company or when you're by yourself?
I've never done it myself, so.
Yeah, me neither. Got questions.
Well, the button on the episode is Molly drawing a picture there in the quarters, and as Brian and Keiko talk over what might have happened on the other side of that portal, how little Molly knew to go back through, and speculating about how Cro-Mag Molly may have coached her to do so. And then Molly shows her picture, and it's just like the one Cro-Mag Molly drew.
Pretty close.
Only better, right?
Yeah, definitely better.
I thought it was interesting that the 8-year-old's version of the picture was like more well executed.
Yeah, Cro-Mag Molly's picture fucking sucked. It's not good.
Do not put that on the fridge.
No. Yeah, we'll just put that in the drawer, Cro-Mag Molly, where all of the things I like the most go.
Yeah. the one drawer in my desk that has a lock on it.
The drawer in my desk that is plugged into the wall and shredded documents come out at the bottom.
You really want to do this here now? Okay, let's do it.
Adam, you hated this episode. I loved this episode, but we have folded pieces of paper that say which we wanted to argue for on this. Are you ready to reveal what you had selected?
I sure am. You ready?
Yeah. Are we going to do this to each other?
Yeah.
All right. 3, 2, 1. We both put negatives.
I think negative is, here's the thing about negative. It's always easier to be negative.
Right.
It's easier to sport fuck a thing than to look at the positive. That's why our show's so hard to do sometimes.
But I had a lot of fun doing it, and I always have a lot of fun looking in our priority one message inbox. Do you want to see what we got over there, Adam?
Okay.
Priority one message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Need a supplemental income.
Supplemental income?
Supplemental.
Supplemental.
Yeah, it's extra.
By the interest alone, could be enough to buy this ship.
Adam, we have a couple of P1s here. The first one is from The Gooch.
The Gooch.
And it's to all F-O-D. Goes like this. Hi, guys. Since I'm getting some supplemental income from hazard pay, yeah, it's extra, I thought I'd buy a P1. In this time of stress, I think it would be good for everyone to get along. Hashtag Razgles and Team Plavim can make peace and come together. Just kidding! Go fuck yourself, Plavim.
What? I never thought we'd hear from the Razgles or Team Plavim ever again.
I'm not totally clear on what happened to the whole Plavim Razgles cinematic universe.
I feel like this P1 was buried under San Francisco. We dusted it off, and there's a P1.
Yeah, except for somehow the Gooch knows about the pandemic, so it can't have been sent back in the heyday of the Raz and Plavim conflict.
Right.
So who knows?
Wow. I do want to say, like, hearing the name the Gooch made me think of an episode of Padma Lakshmi has a food show on Hulu that I've been really enjoying lately.
Oh yeah.
And there's a Hawaiian gentleman that she befriends in one of the episodes, and his last name has like, it's I don't know if it's Yamaguchi or it's like something with Gooch in his last name. Uh-huh. And he just goes by the Gooch, because when you have Gooch as a part of your name,
yeah,
you are the Gooch.
Yeah, I mean, that's an aspirational way to be.
Yeah. Ben, our second priority one message is from Emily the Royal Fizzbin. And if there's two Z's, it's got to be Fitz, right?
Oh.
Like pizza. Emily the Royal Fitzbin. That's how I'll say it.
Okay.
It's to Nicholas the Schralk. The message goes like this. The odds were astronomical. You gave me all the answers to the workplace trivia raffle, but I won the 100 scarves.
Wow.
Thanks for letting me cheat off you. Sorry you didn't win. Was it a Tuesday? I knew this P1 would be a good way to share our winnings. Here's to a continuing friendship of shirking work to chat Star Trek.
Fun.
Hey, that's putting, you know what I like, Ben, is spending found money frivolously.
Yeah.
Like on just some bullshit. And that's what Emily did here.
She bought a round for the people that like Greatest Gen.
Good job by Emily.
And good job by anyone who gets a P1. Of course, to do that, you go to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. It's $100 for a personal message and $200 for a commercial message. And we sure appreciate it.
Gotta get that gold press action.
Are you looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura Frames are beautiful Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. Every mom I have ever given an Aura Frame to has absolutely loved it. And that includes a lot of moms I know. This is a gift that I have personally given many, many times. And it's great. I can upload photos from my phone the moment I take them. And that means that mom or grandma out there is going to get pictures of their loved ones delivered to their living room. And right now, Aura is having a great sale for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com and use the code SCARVES at checkout to show your support for our show. Terms and conditions apply. Mother's Day is coming up, and one of the best gifts you can give a mom that you might share a bed with is doing some yard work downstairs, if you know what I mean, with Manscaped. This season, make sure you groom your carpets and your drapes with the leaders in below-the-waist grooming. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code SCARVES at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping with the code SCARVES at manscaped.com. Nothing like a little spring cleaning in your pants to let the mother of your children know how much you appreciate her continuing to put up with you.
Hey, when you listen to podcasts, it really just comes down to whether or not you like the sound of everyone's voices. My voice is one of the sounds you'll hear on the podcast Dr. Game Show, and this is the voice of co-host and fearless leader Joe Firestone.
This is a podcast where we play games submitted by listeners, and we play them with callers over Zoom we've never spoken to in our lives. So that is basically the concept of the show. Pretty chill.
So take it or leave it, bucko. And here's what some of the listeners have to say.
It's funny, wholesome, and it never fails to make me smile.
I just started listening and I'm already binging it. I haven't laughed this hard in ages. I wish I'd discovered it sooner.
You can find Dr. Game Show on MaximumFun.org.
Video games can make you laugh.
They can make you cry.
They can even make you sing.
We're the hosts of Triple Click.
It's a podcast about video games.
This is an exciting time for new games, from Diablo to Final Fantasy.
From Starfield to Street Fighter.
From Zelda to, oh, who are we kidding? We're just going to talk about Zelda.
Whether you play games or you just like hearing about them, we've got you covered.
Find us at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Bye.
Hey, Adam.
What's that, Ben?
Did you find yourself a drunk Shimoda?
Drunk Shimoda!
Yeah, there's a moment that really stuck out to me this episode, like totally removing all of the mess that is the continuity of this episode just in general. Not the Bajoran security guy, but the Federation security guy that stops Keiko and Miles at the entrance to the runabout.
Yeah.
He's referred to as Jones.
Right. He seemed weird.
That's what I'm saying. He seemed like a guy who won a contest. And I think, and I'm not blaming this on him at all, there's something about how they blocked his scene that made it look like it was a pickup.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. He's kind of shot from a strange angle that doesn't really match the eye lines from the other side.
That's what stuck out to me. I think that was a pretty difficult situation for him to be in. The actor is Randy James, and he plays a lot of uncredited characters on Star Trek. But yeah, tough task.
Yeah,
for him to pull off here. He's got 59 appearances in Deep Space Nine, 22 appearances in TNG. He's in Star Trek First Contact. Just an incredible legacy. I had to imagine not many speaking parts among them, and this is the speaking part.
Wow.
I think you got to do better for Randy James, is what, yeah, I'm saying. I'm telling the episode to do that.
They did Randy dirty.
The thing about Randy Pflug, the actor who plays this guy, is that he's Miles O'Brien's stand-in.
Whoa. That's fun.
Randy James is like his actor name. Randy, right. Pflug is his birth name.
Wow.
And that's got to be fun. You work with a guy as a stand-in for years and years. You get him on camera. It's going to be a real treat.
That's good times. He looks great from behind.
Hey, Randy, I hate to see you go. I love to watch you stand in. So that's my Shimoda. What about you, Ben?
A guy that got stabbed by the bottle. I feel like there is a lot of imagery in our popular culture of people breaking a bottle with the threat to stab. And you sometimes see somebody get slashed with a bottle.
Yeah.
But I can't think of another time I've seen somebody get like impaled on a bottle like that.
It's like the main way I would think of using a broken bottle, though. Also, it seems, yeah, like that's the natural thing to do.
Yeah.
I would never think to slash with it. It seems like you just break it again.
Right. So for being the victim of a thing that I've always wondered about, but I can't think of another time I've actually seen, getting stabbed with a bottle guy is my drunk Shimoda.
All right, Ben, we have fallen all the way down on the game of buttholes rule of the prophets.
Oh yeah, we sure have.
Square 34, and about this moment in the show is when you usually tell us what episode we're going to watch next.
I do that, and the next episode is season 6, episode 25, The Sound of Her Voice. Sisko and the crew race to save a Starfleet captain stranded alone on an oxygen-starved planet.
Whoa.
Yeah, that's going to be a big one.
Yeah, I mean, everyone always talks about the sound of her voice as one of the great DS9 eps, right? Of season six?
No.
But I do like are Star Trek stories about captains that we don't know until that episode. That's fun.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And I guess we'll find out if it's going to be a big episode of our show when I roll the dice on the Game of Buttholes, The Will of the Prophets. We do have a Kanar with Damar out there ahead of us.
Like that square.
We could hit that, but I think that's the only thing unusual that we could hit.
You're required to learn as you play. Roll.
So I'm going to go ahead and roll this thing.
Chula!
Did I win?
Hardly.
Great big roll, Adam. I have rolled a 6. We are now on square 40, making up a lot of the lost time that we gave up on the last roll. So we will have a regular episode next week.
We've got 28 rolls to make it all the way back up to the power hour.
Yeah.
See if we can do it. We keep stubbing our runabout toe.
We do.
It's brutal.
It's brutal.
So many things are crazy making right now, Ben. One thing that that has made our lives a lot less crazy is the field promotion of Bill Tilly to social media management. He's the guy behind our brand new Greatest Trek Twitter feed
and Instagram feed. Yeah. He's doing great work over there. He's like making GIFs. He's telling you about like the birthdays of major characters of the actors who played major characters in the different series. He's retweeting his hilarious trading cards. It's a lot of fun to follow those accounts. So if you're on Twitter or Instagram, follow Greatest Trek.
Some of the great music you've heard on the show is made by great friend of DeSoto and YouTube food sensation Adam Ragusea. Suggest you go over there and learn how to cook yourself something good or grow yourself something good. I saw a tomato tutorial over there. He's growing tomates. He's doing soil samples.
Our show is a different kind of soil sample.
Yeah, sure is. The gross kind.
Give us a couple of bucks. Go to MaximumFun.org/join. We could really use the help.
Sure could. Thanks for that. Thanks for all the 5-star reviews you've given us over the years. Check out our other shows, The Greatest Discovery and the hit war movie podcast, Friendly Fire.
Yeah.
And with that, we'll be back at you next time with another great episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine and an episode of The Greatest Generation Deep Space Nine, which may introduce us to another coin-worthy captain.
Mmm.
What do you think of the chances?
Can't wait.
No one's going to dethrone DeSoto.
Yeah. DeSoto's the king.
You know what? I bet DeSoto could exist on an oxygen-deprived planet, no problem.
Yeah, he's very chill. He's not using that much oxygen.
No, he's just gonna relax. He's just gonna pull up a chair and chill out.
Yeah, he's gonna appreciate the break from hauling his butt back and forth from starbase to starbase.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture. Artist owned.
Audience supported.